It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Sorry about that. Filling in today for Rob Ferret. I'm a fill-in. What do you expect? Coming in just a few moments, we'll look at President Obama's new proposal to bolster educational opportunities for Native American youth around the country.
First, in recent weeks, we've been taking a look at death in America. Today, we're taking a slightly different turn to look at hallucinogens and to a pioneering medical study to find out if mind-altering drugs can reduce the fear and anxiety of death for the terminally ill. To the best of our knowledge, Charles Monroe Kane has the story.
It's your worst-case scenario. You shift in your seat, fiddle with your wedding ring, while the doctor hits you with the news. You have terminal cancer. 4 months to live. What do you do? Dr. Charles Grobe has an idea. He's a psychiatrist and a researcher at Harbor UCLA Medical Center, and he's been conducting studies where he gives psilocybin, the psychoactive component of magic mushrooms, to terminally ill cancer patients. Dr. Grobe says their fear of death often devastates them to the point where they're completely unable to function.
There was one woman, this was her first experience ever with a hallucinogen. She was in her, she's around 50 years old. She had a great deal of anxiety, had been isolating herself from friends, had kind of retreated from the world, waiting to die, and was just in a psychologically very disturbed state.
So Dr. Grobe gave her psilocybin. Let me break this down for you. He gave her a very powerful hallucinogenic drug in a hospital room, and he gave it to a woman who was about to die. But after a few hours, nothing happened. And then he got an idea. He asked his assistant to go down to his car and get him a Dead Can Dance CD.
And within 10 minutes, the floodgates had opened, and tears are streaming down her face. And, you know, I just let her cry. And for her, it was a very, very healing experience. And afterward, her anxiety appeared much less. She had previously, before the study, been on an antidepressant. But afterwards, she found no need to go back on the antidepressant, that it really seemed to re-equilibrate her mood.
Dr. Grobe says that even though this is a medical study, and a lot can be learned from it, it also gave him a unique insight into how we can die.
Having been with my subjects and seeing their courage was very heartening to me. And I would say, take heart, that death need not be an overwhelming existential nightmare. But even in the final moments, there might still be a sense of meaning and a sense of purpose and a sense of moving forward, albeit moving into the unknown, but still a sense of moving forward.
You know, if you were diagnosed with terminal cancer and had only a few months to live, would you want to take psilocybin in your final days?
Well, observing what I observed in my patients who participated in our study, absolutely.
Dr. Grobe says that giving hallucinogenic drugs to those that are terminally ill could be a treatment model. A treatment model for those who are overwhelmed by the grief of their own death.
I think this treatment model allows us to step back and take another perspective, the perspective of what is the subjective experience, and really to imbue an individual with a renewed sense of meaning and purpose, even in their final months, weeks, and days, I think has quite significant implications, not only to what treatment models we may want to pursue in the future, but our understanding of life and the dying process, our final days, and death itself.
Charles Grobe is a psychiatrist at UCLA. This story is part of, to the best of our knowledge, 5-part series on death and dying. If you missed any of the previous stories, you'll find them all at ttbook.org.
The 6th annual White House Tribal Nations Conference took place today in Washington. President Barack Obama welcomed over 500 leaders of the nation's federally recognized tribes. The focus this year, issues facing Native American youth. a group that the White House calls the nation's most vulnerable population.
A big part of the focus will be on education. Today, the president introduced an initiative called Generation Indigenous, which aims to bolster the college and career readiness of Native American children and youth, and a program to increase leadership development and peer support, among other things. But will these new proposals succeed where previous federal policy efforts have failed?
Here to talk to us now about the challenges facing this group is Brian Jackson. He's a program coordinator at the Great Lakes Native American Research Center for Health. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Good evening.
Now, the White House report labels Native American youth as the nation's most vulnerable population. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes.
In your eyes, how are young Native Americans doing here in Wisconsin?
Well, I guess my own personal opinion in the many roles that I'm involved with, there needs to be a greater efforts focusing on some either a pipeline efforts, creating more teacher, Native American teacher opportunities. I think one comes to mind because I know locally here in Lac des Flambeaux, we're struggling at the grade school, even in the high school, of having qualified Native American teachers, which to me makes a big difference. And when we're talking about culturally responsive efforts.
Why does it make a big difference to have the teachers be Native American?
Well, I think the obvious reason is, you know, there's the connection of the understanding of how we, our ways of being are, for one, you know, our histories and our, you know, who we are as Indian people, and how the dynamics are on reservations. You know, those are basic dynamics of, it's really a no-brainer coming from some efforts that we've been involved across, not only in locally, but statewide as well.
Beyond teachers, what are some other challenges for students in schools that are teaching kids on reservations? And
well, I think when I'm talking a pipeline, I'm talking not only for teachers, but I'm talking pipelines for what are opportunities available after high school. You mentioned I'm the coordinator for the American Research Center for Health. I actually coordinate a program at UW-Milwaukee called the American Indian Science Scholars Program, which is geared for high school students. It's one of the very few Native American pre-college programs in the state of Wisconsin with a highly structured, lab-oriented opportunity for high school students, because we are now in four academic institutions in the Milwaukee area, giving opportunity for students to see what kind of different fields are there, not only in the health and field, but just education in general. You know, giving them a taste of campus life and what higher education, what it takes to get into the institution as well.
Now, one of the statistics that people mention as well is that many, many young Native Americans live in poverty. Is poverty a component of this as well, one of the challenges?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look collectively across Indian country, I mean, you know, the opportunity for employment is probably over 50%, I would say, over across the nations. You know, even looking at locally here, I mean, the employment rate is pretty high for the community members.
And so maybe part of that pipeline issue is that, you know, because children are living in poverty, they may not see people who finish their education or go on to college.
Yeah, and I think that's a part of, you know, there's a couple of models that are successful in Wisconsin here. You know, one is I look at the Menominee Nation, what they have, a community engagement model within their school district. And actually, what their superintendent does, what he does is he starts with himself, and he's in charge of three families and goes on to his principals, to his teachers. So they make three connections with families throughout the year, not just for conferences. You know, these are additional, you know, just to check in on.
Just going to meet people, basically, and
well,
spend time?
Well, phone calls, in-person meetings, emails, at least three forms of communications that touch base with families, you know, to see how their son or daughter's experience is going. Because when you look at success rates, they used to be called the dropout factory over in the Menominee Nation. Now their achievement gap is really closing, and their graduation rates are higher now. And that's one of the models that we're starting to implement in the community here in Lac des Flambeaux.
Do you think that the changes that are happening that the president talked about today will help move these things forward even more?
I believe so. I mean, I think they're in the beginning stages. this recently we had William Mendoza, who's on President's cabinet for the White House initiative, which was a tour, and they actually did two tours in Wisconsin. The first tour was in Milwaukee in September, and the second was over in La Crosse last month. And basically what that was they were interviewing students. They wanted to get the student in voice, which was more what they wanted to focus on, talking about, safety in the school and environment, bullying, suicide prevention, culture responsive curriculum, were some of the conversations that were taking place during those tours. And so they were actually going to on tour in other states as well. So they were collecting all these stories from students, which is where, in today's times, which is important because we need to hear the voice of the students so we know how to move forward, meeting their needs, whether it's, curriculum or, environment or poverty issues or suicide, whatever some of those issues are. I mean, we need to address some of those and hearing from them, getting their real stories.
Now, the White House is acknowledging that there have been some past failures in federal policy on education with Native students. What do you think are some of the mistakes that were made in the past by the federal government?
Well, I think for I guess from this, my work I've been involved with this thing is I'm thinking of Wisconsin specifically because we have the statute Act 31, and there's a lot of things that encompass within that Act 31, whether it's mascot logo issues, which was overturned from the governor in Wisconsin back in December of last year, where it has an effect on students, not just in public schools, but in tribal schools and collectively as a whole. Wisconsin, there's 424 public schools, so how can we create stronger awareness in those school districts of what American Indian students go through, not just with poverty, with our struggles of who we are as people, trying to claim our identity and link those, to our past and our histories.
We're talking with Brian Jackson of the Great Lakes Native American Research Center for Health about the challenges facing Native American youth and education. The president released new proposals aimed at improving education and other factors, and you can join the conversation too.
What do you see as the biggest issues facing Native American youth? What do you think needs to improve? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Brian Jackson of the Great Lakes Native American Research Center for Health about the challenges facing Native American youth. The 6th Annual White House Tribal Nations Conference was today in Washington with a focus on bolstering educational opportunities for Native American kids. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments about this at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Brian Jackson, one of the recommendations of the report that came out today is to strengthen tribal control of the education system on reservations. How much control do tribes have right now?
Well, they have the power, each individual tribe. Most tribal communities have their own education directors. In Wisconsin, there's 11 tribal education directors that make up their association, and they actually meet every other month, along with the Wisconsin Indian Education Association. Definitely they have a lot of power as having control. And part of that control is, too, is making relationships or partnerships within their schools that are adjacent to their reservations or communities. And the reason I say that is because MOUs is a big push across Wisconsin tribal communities now.
And what is an MOU? I'm sorry.
Memorandum of Understanding.
Oh, I see. Okay. And, between school districts and
tribal communities.
Yeah.
And and education departments. And so basically, what that is, that'll vary from community to communities. But what does the curriculum look like? For Indian students, what kind of staff do they have in place? What kind of relationships are built? And I think the most importantly, when I say liaisons, because I think of each high school having either a homeschool coordinator that's Native American, to address some of these concerns, either it's when you got students that are maybe truant or, having some other issues of suicide. These homeschool coordinators and other liaisons, come into some huge, play when it comes to connecting with students and getting the students back on track, back in school.
Well, we have lots of people wanting to join the conversation. Let's go to Jim in Rice Lake first. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. I'm not Native, but I teach at a Native American community college in Slayer County. And one of the things I think we see at our community college is that the curriculum doesn't just have rigor, it has relevance. It has relevance in the sense that Native traditions are taught throughout the programming, whether it be mathematics, whether it be science, whether it be law. And I think the students reconnect with education, which they didn't get within the for want of another phrase, the white public school system that some of them have gone to. And I'm particularly disappointed with Scott Walker's recent legislation to allow Native American, what I call caricatures, not mascots, within the Wisconsin State Public School System, because I believe it is contrary to the interests of our society as a whole, not just Native people. I'll take my response off the air.
Okay, Jim. Thanks for that call. Brian Jackson, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I appreciate that call, too, because some of the things I did allude to earlier was when we're talking about culture response and curriculum or efforts. You know, a lot of those efforts are taking place in communities of, you know, for example, whether they're including, like, wild rice time in September, where students are allowed to go out and harvest rice, or if it's spearfishing time, you know, students are allowed to come in a little bit later so they can practice some of those ways. You know, and a lot of that science-related, too, you know, as a gentleman from Rice Lake mentioned. And a friend of mine, his name is Running Horse, and he teaches a curriculum called Wigometry, and it's a different way of understanding math. You know,
Wigometry?
Wigometry.
Okay.
And so, and it's you know, basically what he does is he asks the question of how are we going to you know, look at the problem and the solution, you know, itself when you're looking at a math problem. So yeah, there's a lot of efforts of you know, you're looking at tying in some of those ways of being that are into, you know, as examples I mentioned. And also, the other piece that the gentleman mentioned from Rice Lake was the mascot logo issue I mentioned. I think a lot of folks in Indian country are very disappointed as well. Bart Munson, who I give hats off to, who was our mascot logo coordinator for Wisconsin, she actually is out there in the schools. It was part of the McGuanago case outside of Milwaukee, her and Richie Plass, Moneta, I mean, two big champions that are out there lobbying hard to get the, this overturned, you know, hopefully in the years to come, because it truly it does have an effect, you know, of students, you know, of, whether it's regionally, nationally, you know, the big national news is, you know, the Washington Redskins, you know, the big crowd they had over at the Viking-Packer game there, or it was the Viking-Redskins game, I believe,
yeah.
Minneapolis or a couple weeks ago.
Well, we're going to go to another call. I have a couple more I'd like to try to get to here. Reed from Clintonville. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
Yes, thank you. Say, I spent 25 years of my 37-year teaching career on the Menominee Indian Reservation as an educator, art educator. And it was one of the best and most rewarding experiences of my life. I would say that I really ran into, and I'm non-Native person, by the way, but the only problems, the real problems that I ran into, of course, were poverty and attenuate baggage that students brought to class, I think, primarily impacted by or caused by much of the poverty that Native peoples have been subjected to. I might say that the Menominee Nation and Menominee County border lines, run contiguous, and both Menominee County and Menominee Nation has the highest unemployment rate in the state, something which our governor has not admitted to or addressed in any way, shape, or form. And it's nothing more than a slap in the face of our great historic nations, Native nations here in the state. But my students were wonderful, joyous students. I do wish we'd had more Native teachers in the Menominee Indian School District, but it was a privilege and a pleasure and a joy and an honor to have served those people. And
Well, Reed, thanks for that call. Brian Jackson, I mean, one of the things that Reed mentioned that I'd like you to respond to a little bit is he talked a little bit about out-of-classroom issues that the students had to deal with. It seems like that reinforces the importance of the outreach that you were talking about earlier. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's definitely for sure. I mean, you know, as a gentleman, you know, from Clintonville there had mentioned about the baggage that's carried into students coming in late or dealing with a lot of, whether it's drugs and alcohol in the home, single parents, or, you know, parents not being there during the evening to have to work, where younger ones have to, you know, be the babysitter and kind of look after their younger ones. And, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of different, you know, there's a lot of similarities, I should say, in a lot of the communities that, you know, I see in the community I work with, too, in like the Flambeau, you know, and, you know, but, you know, I think with those types of efforts of outreach, you know, an example that I give was because, you know, we have the caller ID, you know, that everybody knows about. And so when you see the school number come across your caller ID, you know, a couple of things come to mind here in the community. One is, you know, something's wrong with your son or daughter. Either, you know, they're sick, secondly. Or third, it's the automated message. And so my theme is, too, we have to reverse that perspective and be able to, you know, connect and give a outreach effort to a parent or family person saying, hey, how was your son or daughter's experience at the school so far? We want to congratulate your son or daughter making honor roll. We're encouraged that they're out for a sport, after school activity, you know, something along those lines. Some positive communications, you know, monthly, I think would definitely change and get more parent involvement in schools.
Well, Brian Jackson, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, I appreciate the time and the thoughts for having me.
Well, that was Brian Jackson. He's a program coordinator of the Great Lakes Native American Research Center in for Health in Lac du Flambeau. It's time for Wisconsin Life. It's no surprise to find an artisan coffee roaster in somewhere like Milwaukee or Madison, but you might not expect to find one in a garage in the tiny town of Hiles in Forest County.
With several orders lined up for his espresso blend, Dave Roberts fires up his boxy metal roaster.
It's very tricky to roast light batches, smaller batches, and I have to do that.
As it roars, the roaster heats up to about 500 degrees. After about 10 minutes, the beans start to darken and the air fills with a toasted smell. Roberts quickly shuts off the gas and pours the beans onto a metal tray to cool. Roberts hasn't always been an experienced roaster. At the age of 55, he made an unusual career change.
My family had a logging business and a sawmill business, and we were about to sell that. That's when I kind of gravitated towards coffee roasting.
So you used to, like, operate the sawmill?
That's right, yes. And logging, hauling pulpwood.
It's an interesting switch.
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah, more from something that's really, really industrial to something more artsy, I guess you could say.
Faced with declining harvests and revenues, his family sold the sawmill and Roberts looked for something to ease the transition into retirement. His brother was in the coffee business on the West Coast, so Roberts thought he'd try roasting too. Rio Lobo, named for the nearby Wolf River, started out as a hobby, a way to make a little extra money. But it wasn't easy to find a market in the North Woods, where artisan coffee wasn't exactly booming.
And it was just really difficult getting any customers at all. The first few years, it was just ridiculous.
Existing coffee houses were reluctant to switch to a new brand, and Roberts wasn't interested in starting his own shop. After all, he didn't want his coffee project to interfere with other important retirement pursuits like fishing and grouse hunting.
So what I did with, I thought if I want to roast any coffee at all, I'll just appeal to the people. I'll go around to individuals, and that's what I've been doing.
Even so, Roberts has sometimes come up against what could be termed a cultural obstacle.
There are people that do not like fresh coffee.
Whether it's the strong flavor or just the idea of specialty coffee, Roberts says he has encountered skeptics.
I have friends that just will not. I mean, they're very close friends. And I'll just tell them, well, I know what you want. You want me to keep the coffee. and set it on a shelf for about 3 months at least. And then you'll like my coffee because it'll be quite stale. That's what you want.
On the other hand, Rio Lobo has also found plenty of enthusiasts. More than 10 years after he started his roasting enterprise, Roberts has about 100 customers who love the fact that he roasts the beans pretty much on demand. Still, he remains humble about his enterprise.
And I don't think that it's so special that it's better than what can be produced, but they're getting good coffee for a reasonable price. So, I mean, that's sort of the draw. That's what I'm trying to do.
For Dave Roberts, doing what he wants to do is working out just fine.
That story was produced by Natalie Jablonski, Community Features Editor for WXPR. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Now we're focusing on something we who work in radio think about a lot, the sound of your voice. The way your voice sounds can have a huge impact on what people think about you, whether you like it or not, and it's particularly challenging for women. Studies show that many people perceive voices that sound feminine as insecure, incompetent, and less trustworthy.
Christy Block is with us to talk about gender bias in voice. She's a speech-language pathologist who specializes in voice. Her private practice, New York Speech and Voice Lab, is in Manhattan. Christy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So when people come to you to get your help working with their voice, what are some of the reasons that bring them there?
Well, there are people who want to come and learn how to sound more professional or sound more masculine. Women do ask me to help them with those things. Sometimes also... oftentimes I help people with voice problems as well, voice disorders, to help them with healthy voice. Sometimes I'll have women who are speaking in a more masculine way, and it's actually becoming an unhealthy habit for their vocal cords.
There is some research out there now that women in particular may suffer in the career, in other arenas of their life, based on the sounds of their voice. What is seen as a typically female voice habit?
Typical female sound is a higher pitch, it's lighter and smaller, the pitch moves around more than a masculine voice. Sometimes it goes up at the end of the sentence, like I'm doing now. Sometimes referred to as uptalk. The transitions of the pitch movement are often smooth, like I'm speaking now. Ways of what would be considered feminine speaking can also be related to how many words a person says or how, or being a little less direct.
So you're talking about the content as well as the quality?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And do you work on those
Absolutely.
Areas too?
Pardon?
Do you work on those areas too, the content areas?
Yes, yes. So, the words you choose to say are more about how many words you use and then putting that together with the sound, the different, the pitch, the intonation, how loud you are, how slow you are, those things.
And what about a typically masculine voice? What does a typically masculine voice sound like?
So on the flip side, lower, heavier, bigger sound, more downward pitch movement at the end of a phrase. And when stressing words, the stress can sound a little bit more heavy or staccato or abrupt. So... Obama is actually a good example of that. His pitch often goes down when he talks at the end of a phrase. It often goes down like this, and it often sounds staccato.
That's pretty good, Obama. Yeah.
I'm trying.
Are women, if they want to be taken seriously on the job, to be seen as competent and trustworthy, do women need to sound more like men?
I think women need to feel confident. So sometimes that can involve sounding more masculine to a certain extent. But it is also about being more aware of what you sound like and how you can manipulate how you sound in different situations and find your own individual voice.
So finding your own voice, that sounds like something everyone wants to do, man or woman. How do you yeah. find that authentic voice?
Well, you work with the biology first. So we, you know, own the pitch of our voice and how big or small our voices sound is based on our biology. So how big your vocal cords are. And how big of a space, a resonating chamber you have, how big your neck and head are, actually. So you think about figuring out how to play your musical instrument. I lost my train of thought. So you asked me
about finding your authentic voice.
Finding your authentic. So you work with what you have, and you try different ways. Well, I have people think about what they like and what they don't like, and what kinds of judgments they've got from other people. And a lot of it is about being aware of what you're already doing in different situations, and what is successful and what. Is less successful, and then work from there in terms of what is useful in what situation. And so I think an authentic voice is so much about what is a confident sound for that person that feels good, that works for what they're trying to do in the situation.
You mentioned uptalk earlier as something that women in particular may have to deal with. It might be a typically feminine speech pattern. So this is when you sort of turn everything into a question and you inflect up at the end. How do you think that's perceived, and how can a woman learn to correct that if she wants to move in a different direction?
So, yeah, uptalk is something that is considered feminine. Not all women do this, but it certainly is a... is something that people consider feminine. You know, changing how you talk, it just takes practice. So you hear models of what is an alternative, and you practice doing that. And then you're mindful of how you're talking in the moment. So if I give you an example, if I order a coffee, I could do it in a more feminine way. I like to order my coffee. I usually get a medium coffee, and I like it with milk and without sugar. So I could ask it in a more feminine way, which would be, could I have a medium coffee with milk, no sugar, please? Or I could say it like this, medium coffee, milk, no sugar, thanks.
Wow.
So the first one goes up at the end, right? And the second one goes down at the end. And so the second one also uses fewer words. So it just would be a matter of thinking how to say something and practicing going downward at the end.
You know, I'm torn listening to that. Your example there was just really striking. The two were incredibly different. But on the other hand, we really shouldn't be judging people's intelligence or competence or trustworthiness based on their voice, should we?
That's right. Exactly. Judgments about talking are judgments about behavior. If we judge other people, like on how they dress or how they or the car they drive, those kinds of things, we clearly see as judgments. And sometimes we forget when we judge people on the way they talk. We think of it as something different, but it's not. And really, the way people talk. It's all inherently equal. There's nothing, inherently different about one way or the other. When the negativity comes in, it's only our own personal bias.
We're talking to speech-language pathologist Christy Block about gender bias in voice.
And we're taking your calls, too. How do you feel people judge you based on the sound of your voice? Do you think your voice is a fair representation of who you are? Do you judge others based on the sound of their voice? We'd like to hear your stories. Call in and tell us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation now with speech-language pathologist Christy Block about how we judge typically feminine voices more harshly than typically masculine voices.
And we want to hear from you. How do people judge you based on the sound of your voice? Have you been discriminated against because of the way you sound? Do you ever catch yourself judging other people because of their voice? Call in and join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers right now and take our first call from Samantha in Galesville. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. So the reason I'm calling is because I have a job where I get to speak with people from all over the United States. It's at a call center. And I instantly know when I speak to the person before I even pull their information up where they're from. And even though I don't try, my mind judges them based on what their intelligence level might be, whether they be from the South, East Coast, West Coast, or whatnot.
So is it the particular accents of those regions that you find yourself judging, or is it the voices themselves?
It's the accents. I tend to hear people from the South, and I can instantly know if they're from Louisiana or Virginia, areas like that. And for some reason, my mind wants to think that they're less intelligent, and I know that's not correct.
All right. Well, thank you, Samantha, and thanks for your honesty, too. I imagine this goes on all the time, whether or not we're talking about it. And Christy, is this something that people come to you for, that they want to rid themselves of their accents?
Yes, that certainly is something that people work on with me, and it's really a common problem too. And I think it's just another side of the coin. Different regions where we're from, different accents, or different socioeconomic class, or race, there, and gender. They all involve different viewpoints, and negativity can come into play of everybody judging each other. And certainly there's power dynamic and inequalities involved. And we need to be very careful in terms of naming our judgments. And so it's really good that the caller said that she tries to catch herself. There's a really great documentary, a PBS documentary, that came out in 1988, but I think it's still relevant. It's called American Tongues, and it's about people's perceptions of other people's accents in English, and it's really fascinating.
Well, thanks a lot, Samantha. Appreciate that, and a documentary we should be checking out. Thank you for that recommendation, Christy. And we're going to go next to PJ, who's joining us in Waupun. Hi, PJ.
Hi. I've been judged for the sound of my voice for a long time, and I don't know how old you think I sound, but on occasion I have had to, when I needed to get respect and get something done, I've had to say, look, I'm really not as young as I sound, and here's what I need you to do. I have a master's degree and blah, 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 and I just need you to respect me because I'm not as young as I sound.
Oh, so you have to trot out the master's degree to get the respect you think you need. And does it work then when you actually call people out on how you think you're being perceived? Do you?
It has.
It does.
It
okay.
It really has, yeah. And, but my question, not just to comment on how young and squeaky I sound, but lately I feel that younger people in their 20s, they're doing something I find interesting. I don't know what it's called. They kind of suck back their words and they have this kind of a sound. I don't know if it has a term. It's like do you understand what I mean?
All right. Thanks, PJ. Christy, does that sound familiar, a certain affect for people in the millennial generation?
Yes, it's that vocal fry or glottal fry that
people have become more aware of, and is more common among young women lately. And it's typically when a person tries to speak way down low in their lower register, and it's usually with not enough breath support. And sometimes for younger people, in my experience, when I've worked with folks on this, it could be a more relaxed, hey, I'm cool, I'm relaxed in conversation here. But it also can be related to trying to sound more professional or more masculine in like a masculine work environment. My office is in the financial district in Manhattan near Wall Street, and I've had quite a few younger women who have that problem. And so it's an attempt. It can sometimes be an attempt to sound different, but it could sometimes lead to vocal problems.
And I want to ask you heard PJ's voice there, and she's obviously had trouble. She feels commanding the respect that she deserves. She has to mention her master's degree. What would you tell her, just having heard her voice for 15 seconds?
Well, I would say bravo for telling them, you know, this is really how I sound. And it is too bad that you have to justify yourself. And I have been in that situation, too, when years ago when I was teaching and I was younger. When you're, no matter what your age, if you sound younger, sometimes that can certainly be seen in a negative light. So, and I think it's great for people to say, hey, this is just how it is. This is how I am. And, you know, this is what it looks like. So some people do come in to work on modifying their voices, and that can involve trying to sound, get a bigger sound with the space you have and the vocal folds you have, and then with some practice you can modify it slightly. If you feel like it's really getting in the way, for some people it really affects their job, or they're not even listened to. And it could, you know, some people aren't in the situation to be able to say, hey, you know, this is it, deal with it.
And as we get ready to wrap up here, I want to ask you, a lot of the way our voice sounds seems like it's something that's decided subconsciously, sort of based on who we heard growing up, where we live. How difficult is it to change our vocal habits?
I think it's possible. It's definitely, it's just a matter of how much. It could be challenging because we're changing, as you say, these habits that are happened naturally over time. But it's just with a lot of practice and becoming aware of how to modify what you're doing, and also being mindful of your speaking in the moment. A little change can make a big difference.
And have you seen that in your practice? Have you seen people's lives transformed briefly?
Yes. There often will be a specific goal, like somebody who had trouble giving a presentation and wanting to do better with that. So having a very specific goal, that is can be a very obvious improvement. Other people just feel more confident and notice a change that way.
Christy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Christy Block, a speech-language pathologist who specializes in voice. Her private practice, New York Speech and Voice Lab, is online at nyspeechandvoicelab.net.